Western psychology has more or less taken the attitude that it is essential to the psychic integration of Western man for him to be under a condition of more or less constant tension. It is assumed that without pressure, the individual will fall apart. We are held together by not only the pressures of our own personalities, but the pressures of our desires, our ambitions, and our attitudes. It is taken for granted that if the individual was not constantly striving after something, he would vegetate. He would cease to develop the resources which we like to associate with the dynamic personality. We like to point out also that Western civilization is a monument to the accomplishment of pressures. If it had not been for a constant pattern of affliction, war, strife, the pressure of situations and circumstances, it is assumed that we would all be back in the Stone Age. Well, we can build a pretty strong case for pressure. We can build a great deal to support the idea that the ambitious man forges ahead in the world, and the person without ambition seldom, if ever, gets too far in the battle of life. Up to very recently, we could philosophize about all these problems. We could say of pressure that we can take it or leave it. But by degrees, many of the beliefs that we have held to be the basic truths of society have been shattered by circumstances which have demonstrated that there is something basically wrong with the concept of the pressured life. The individual may seemingly get a little further under extreme pressure, but he is a little like the old-fashioned horse that was attached to the beer truck back in those good old days of cobblestones and great dray horses pulling huge loads. And very often the load was more than the horse could take. So the driver would lash out with his whip and beat the horse unmercifully. And in a desperate effort to escape further flogging, the horse would maybe get to the top of the difficult hill. And the driver was quite convinced that that's the way to treat a horse. But, of course, the horse didn't last very long. Very shortly, the horse was through, as far as its usefulness was concerned, to say nothing of the unfair and terrible damage which we inflicted upon another living thing. There is no gain that we can learn that is permanent or valuable that arises from beating oneself beyond a certain rather limited degree. We are not supposed to be lazy, but we are not supposed to live constantly under tension. The Western man has tried this long enough. And incidentally, he has contributed a great deal to the tension of all other peoples and nations. Probably a good part of the world would be happier than it is today if there had never been a Western civilization. Because it was so geared to ambition, to conquest, to the extension of commerce and industry, to the rather ruthless colonization of primitive peoples, that this vast program of success at all costs has not only complicated our lives, but hangs heavy over us at the moment, as other nations are beginning to reach that degree of strength in which they can show their resentment for the ill treatment that Western peoples have given them in the past. So I think about all that this unreasonable ambition has resulted in is sickness, death, and hate. It has brought with it very little that we can say has truly advanced the course of our destiny. But we have created our own patterns of what we consider to be advancement. And we are still struggling with the idea that the more contrivances we can get into orbit, the more advanced we are. Actually, one of these days, the traffic congestion up there will be worse than it is here. And still, we will not be very advanced. Because this has nothing to do with essential progress. In the East, men have tried to solve this pressure problem. They've had pressures, too. Probably not nearly as great as ours, nor as continuous. But they've had to work with the pressure problem, and it has become more essential as a problem ever since the East and West began to mingle their resources. Zen takes the attitude that pressure is not in any basic sense the key to success. Pressure is an individual bestowing upon himself a powerful stimulant, which is not really a tonic or a food, but merely a stimulation. The ambitions of Western peoples are not advancing the total character of the individual or the total good of Western culture. These ambitions are simply false stimulants. They are stimulants which cause the individual to develop all kinds of strange personality defects, very much as extreme alcoholism. Not only weakens character, but reveals inherent weaknesses to a most unfortunate degree. So we have to begin to estimate the difference between strength and mere inebriation or stimulation of a false nature. Zen takes the ground that the only way in which you can accomplish a great deal without hurting yourself and without hurting other people is to move from a kind of effortlessness within yourself. The moment you become dramatically aggressive, you also become offensive. The aggressive person is hurting other people, interfering with their rights, damaging their prospects, and to a measure, annoying them and destroying their peace of mind. It is not on such a ground of mutual annoyances that progress can be achieved. And what appears to be progress, again, is only a kind of acidity, a psychic toxin, which is mistaken for a legitimate vitality. You can intoxicate a structure, a particularly glandular in the human body, and make it seem to work more rapidly and more successfully than is really the case. But this so-called overfunction is not a proof of strength, but a proof of the weakness of the gland, which is showing a kind of toxic exhaustion and is not actually in a healthy state at all. Zen would like to take the ground that man's success in life is due to the conservation of resources and not the abandonment of self to an energy outburst. Energy is the thing upon which all must be motivated or by which it must be fueled. Man's supply of energy is therefore really the most priceless thing that he has. As he wastes energy, he begins to experience the lack of it and finds exhaustion, fatigue creeping in on him. He finds that his interests in life become less keen, and little by little, from lack of energy, all purpose collapses as far as his psychology is concerned. So we have to conserve energy. On the Western side of things, we measure achievement by energy expenditure. We put a pound of energy behind something, then we have a pound of achievement. We put 100 pounds of energy, we have 100 pounds of achievement. It's all energy. We think of the amount of stress as indicating the activity of the individual. This activity, however, may be nothing more than a kind of meaningless confusion. In the Zen thinking, energy must be conserved. The problem is to achieve the greatest amount of result with the least expenditure of energy. We know, for example, in the old days when American Indian runners carried messages across this country, that it was necessary for them to achieve a certain pacing. They still do it on in the reservations of the Southwest. An American Indian can take a kind of dog trot. He will go no faster and no slower. And on this trotting pace, he can accomplish a prodigious amount of travel. He can go for hours, apparently, without fatigue. He can outdistance those who run and hasten and hurry by just keeping up this peculiar rhythmic trot. He has learned just exactly how rapidly this trot should be geared so far as he is concerned. It differs with everyone. He knows his pace, he keeps it. And there are cases where Indians have kept this trot without really pausing at all for 12, 14, 16 hours. Had they hurried, they could not possibly have done it. Their brother in the East, the old rickshaw driver who has now disappeared, had this same prodigious power. Behind the staffs of his rickshaw, between them more likely, he was able to go on for hours at this dog trot. I remember many years ago, when there were still rickshaws in the area, a rickshaw driver who made a 40-mile round trip without stopping, dragging a load. But he would never go beyond a certain speed. He would never hurry. He would go along with a strange rhythmic trot. He was conserving energy. Now in Zen, this idea is carried a step further. Every ounce of energy that we possess must be used. It must be used as wisely and sparingly as possible. Nature reconstructs our energy patterns to some degree. But if we exhaust them too much, nature cannot revive or replace this wasted energy as rapidly as we waste it. As a result, over a long period of time, our vital resources gradually decline. If, however, at all times in life, we try to use energy to the utmost, getting from every unit of energy all of the true usefulness that is possible, we will find that nature has rather wonderfully provided us with the fuel of life, by means of which we can accomplish most of the reasonable things that we desire. It will be obvious that work of all kinds is energy consuming. But today, work is far less a problem for Western man than at any other time in history. But as his hours shorten, it seems that his capacity shortens. The individual psychologically is more tired now after 7 days with 5 coffee breaks than he used to be when he worked 12 hours a day, 6 days a week. If he had to do the work that his grandfather did, he probably would collapse in his tracks. So what has he accomplished since the time of his grandfather? He has accomplished inability. He has accomplished the mysterious circumstance of not being able to do what his own forefathers did. Now, the answer was not merely that Grandfather had better stamina. It was that Grandfather was a better organized person. Now, this might not have been Grandfather's fault. He may not have known very much about being a better organized anybody. But he had one advantage. Simplicity. His needs were simple. His expectations were simple. The world that he lived in was rather non-competitive in comparison to today. His life was free from most of the extraordinary ambitions that affect modern man. He was also not so much of a conspirator as his descendants. He wasn't doing everything he possibly could with his emotional and mental resources to fight his way to the top, even by unfair means. This grandfather, with a simpler way of life, probably healthier food, fewer ambitions, and no great demands upon life or unreasonable luxuries, lived to a good old age under fair opportunity and conserved energy resources. We see a few of these people now. I've known a number of them along the way. I've known many persons who have reached 90 with every tooth in their heads. Some of them with hardly a filling. I had a grandmother who died at 70. She'd never had a filling in a tooth. These people just live differently. Today, by the time we are 65, we've shaken all our teeth loose with worry and fear. Our digestion is so bad that acidity has eaten up our mouths. And we are just unhappy due to pressures that our ancestors never knew. What is the best way to handle this type of thing? We can't go backwards. We don't want to. We don't want to go back to the 12-hour day. But what we do want to do is to go backward or forward or whatever is necessary to a condition in which, as individuals, we are sufficient to our own needs as human beings. That we can live with ourselves. That we can use our energy allotments constructively and reasonably, and will not waste the larger part of this allotment that is given to us. Tests have been made, others undoubtedly are in the making at the moment, to determine exactly how we use energy and what happens when we short-circuit our own systems. And every bit of information that has accumulated up to now straight forth tells us the facts of the matter. Actually, emotional and mental stress today work a greater hardship upon our economy as persons than the 12-hour day did upon the lives of our ancestors. Our great-grandfather, perhaps, who went out and plowed a field from morning till night with a rifle strung over his shoulder, he had a difficult life. He even had a life which might have encouraged considerable neurosis. But he also had about him certain values that helped simplify things for him. One thing he had was faith. He believed in the simple facts of his religion. May have been a little narrow, but what he believed, he tried to live. He also believed in himself. He believed in his family. He believed in the importance of clearing that back 40 acres of stumps and old broken down dead trees in order that his sons might have farms when they grew up. But pretty soon his sons were out there helping him clear the land. This was a different kind of world. It was a world in which there was very much less neurosis than there is today. Simply because people had plans, programs, simple projects, and stayed with them. So our Zen teaching says, let's start by saving energy. Let's save energy by having a program. Never wake up in the morning for a day which you are going to approach as you might by firing both barrels of a shotgun and hoping to hit something. The day has a reason and a purpose. If you have no idea what you are going to do with it, then you might as well settle down quietly for a little while before the day gets well underway and decide what you're going to do with it. A day that is meaningless, a day that is purposeless, is just an energy waster. And where energy is wasted in this way, nearly always consequences are set in motion that demand more energy to repair damage. We cannot have a meaningless day without something coming along by which we hurt ourselves. If this meaningless day really was nothing, it wouldn't be quite so bad. But this meaningless day, made through boredom, lead us to extravagance that is desperately dangerous to us. So we can't afford this kind of a day. We have to have some reason for getting up in the morning. Now, we have reasons in the West for getting up. One is the job. It means that we got to drag ourselves out and get down to the old office or factory or something of that nature on time or have our pay docked. This is called the incentive system. But no one seems to be very much thrilled by it. Actually, the job has to be done. We have to pay the bills of life, there's no doubt about it. But an individual whose life is only a job is missing a great deal of something. The individual whose life is not only just a job, but just a job which he resents, a job in which he finds no satisfaction, but simply a monotonous repetition of an assigned task, for no purpose. Well, perhaps there is a purpose. The man has a family. He is duty-bound to do what he can to support and advance the state of that family. So he must work to make sure that these others have what they need. But today, the work program is such that if the individual takes all negative emotion out of it, takes all boredom and resentment out of it, frees himself from the self-pity angle of the job. Like the man who says, I work all day and earn the money. I don't even get a dime out of it myself. It all goes to the family. This is self-pity. And while this remains as the psychology of life for that individual, self-pity can end only in a pitiful state for him. So whatever we are doing with this problem of daily survival, we've got to think it through, organize it, and get the acidity out of it. If it's a job that needs doing, then it has to be done. And all regrets, all evasions, all excuses, and all flag waving, and all revolutions have nothing to do with the simple fact that if we have a responsibility, we have to meet it. If we have bills, we have to pay them. Now, the moment we begin to stop thinking in this direct way, we start running up bills we can't pay and begin the old song that the world owes us a living or something of that nature and go from bad to worse. The simple answer is when you get up in the morning, plan your day and understand your day, realizing that this day must in many ways be a day of acceptances. You are committed by yesterday to many things, and today you will commit tomorrow to some things. This is not bad, but if you do it, face it, accept it, and carry the responsibilities that you yourself have voluntarily assumed. When you get through with the basic pattern of the day, the day's responsibilities. Then what have you planned? What have you done to solve the problem? Well, you say by the time the day is over, there's not much you can do. I'm worn out. Responsibilities have cut me down. Barely have strength enough to get back home and turn on the television. If that doesn't wear you down, you're really a massive character. But actually, experiment has shown, under very careful test situations, that a person coming home from work is exactly like a child in the various grade rooms of a school. The individual who comes back from work is not tired, except in a very few cases. Maybe 10% of workers are physically tired. The other 90% are bored to distraction, worn out, complaining, fussing, frustrated, neurotic, but not tired. The exhaustion is psychic fatigue. They have sold themselves to the fact that they are worn down to a frazzle. They're worn out simply because it is the only way in which they can excuse the fact that as personal beings, they have no lives. An individual doesn't like to come home to himself or anyone else and say, well, I've done my shift in the office, and I'm now coming home and I'm going to fall apart because there's absolutely nothing here that means anything to me. I don't find any pleasure in my home. I find nothing stimulating in it. I find no reason to be glad I'm here. So fortunately, I'm worn out and I can go to sleep. This is just an excuse mechanism within the person himself. While he's all quiet there, ready to collapse from his fatigue mechanism, the doorbell rings. And a visitor comes in who he's very glad to see. Within a few moments, he's forgotten that he's tired, and they're chatting along and having a perfectly grand time. His fatigue is gone. Because his fatigue was nothing but boredom with himself. In the same general way, children, having gone through several hours of schooling, are fatigued in certain faculties of the mind. Give them something else to do, they're not fatigued. You tell the child that is all tired out learning reading, writing, arithmetic, and there are not many that are so fatigued at that these days. Well, anyway, presume that they are. Tell them that there's going to be a good tennis game or a swimming match or something. They'll have strength enough to go on with it. And after one of those horrible days of examinations in school when they're just worn to a frazzle, they can still dance all night. Why? Because energy follows interest. And nearly every individual who is chronically tired is simply chronically bored. Now, there are exceptions, of course, if the person is physically sick. If there's some desperate impairment to vitality, if some ailment is eating into the resources, or if the person is one of that small percentage who is legitimately worn out. All that we say does not apply to them. But it does apply to the average person. It applies even to the person who thinks they're pretty busy. You will find, if you look into your own life, that you are seldom so tired that you cannot do what you really want to do. You are so tired you can hardly drag one foot in front of the other. But the newspaper says it is a month-end sale with rare bargains. Suddenly your energy enables you to go downtown and fight in a store for 8 hours. Being trampled on and trampling on in the hope of saving $1.16. Your energy comes back. It comes back because it follows interest. It follows the mind. The main point we'd like to make is that energy resources are turned on and off by the mind. That when the mind says, I'm weary, then we are really tired. When the mind decides it's made a slight error of judgment and we're not as tired as we thought we were, and we can still go out and have a pleasant time with our friends, then we find we can do all of these things. Modern man in Western world is not so physically fatigued that he cannot do nearly anything that he wants to do. But more and more in this generation, he does not want to do anything. He's slowly turning down the wick of his own lamp. He seems almost bent on a slow suicide. He wishes to completely destroy himself. He wishes to surround himself with hopelessness and helplessness. If you ask him, he will deny it. But watch him, and you will see him prove it day after day. Now, why should a person do this? Why should an individual who has a good job and a fairly satisfactory marriage, good children, fair prospects for a future, a good education themselves, why should this individual want to turn down the energy supply until finally they snuff themselves out? The only possible answer to this is some kind of internal frustration, fear, boredom, helplessness, or a feeling of total individual or collective futility. Why should a person today, who has so many advantages and privileges, have so very little interest in being energetic, in using energy constructively? I think one answer is the general situation of his world. Nothing seems to be very right. The future looks very dangerous. There seems very small chance of peace, of friendship, of brotherhood in the world. It looks as though we might all be on the verge of some strange, mysterious catastrophe. The individual cannot plan with securities. He cannot do what men did even two generations ago. I remember growing up in New York. You got a job. One of the brokerage houses or insurance houses or one of the Wall Street castles that stood in those days. You were a young man in your late teens, maybe. You went in with your best suit on, creases pressed out of your pants. You received an indoctrination for the president. Maybe the only time you ever saw him, but you saw him then. And he told you very simply that you were going to work for a great and wonderful corporation, one of high honor and great integrity. And he said very simply, be honest, do your job well, you will get ahead in the business, and if you're faithful to us, you will never have to worry again as long as you live about a job. You will have one until you retire. When you retire, they'll give you a grandfather's clock thrown in. There was no problem. There was no one chiseling for your job. There was no one waiting desperately to make sure that you didn't succeed. If you did your work, you could relax. You had your job. You had to fail the job, or the job would not fail you. And generation after generation of American business people lived by that. Now it's all gone. No one's secure in these things anymore. And where there is no security, there's no planning, there's no building, we have this dangerous situation of losing interest in tomorrow, losing interest in trying to build a pattern of purpose. And I think Western man today is terribly frustrated because he cannot build a plan. He cannot save with any sense of security. He cannot invest with any sense of security. He cannot build for tomorrow with any real confidence that tomorrow will be the fulfillment of the plan he is setting in motion. Lacking all of these securities, he has lost long-range thinking, long-range judgment. He has tried to live it up immediately because he didn't know what tomorrow would ever bring with it. This type of desperation is another way of wasting energy. And you come to a series of pretty solid statements. It takes a certain amount of energy to shovel dirt. It takes a certain amount of energy to work a great machine or pound a typewriter. Everything takes a certain amount of energy, but it takes infinitely more energy to fight personality conflicts than it does in any other form of activity in which we indulge. A good worrier, in a few hours, can use up more energy than would be necessary for him to get out and solve the problem he's worrying about. Grief tears down energy far more rapidly than the human system can build it back. We are all subject to grief. Nature will take care of grief for a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, even 6 months. Because nature expects this grief to gradually clear, and it usually does. But when an individual settles down to nurse a grief, building psychological fortification to this grief until gradually it possesses them, so that they settle down to be professional grievers over a lifetime, nature cannot fight this. Nature cannot restore this wasted energy. And the individual gradually becomes ill in some one of many parts of his life. He loses his energy supply. He is exhausted. He is worn out. And for lack of energy, the body functions begin to go. And when the various vital organs are de-energized by waste, serious illness is not far off. Hates use up more energy than any amount of physical life and its problem that we ever have to face. The individual who grumbles about being tired from 8 hours of work doesn't realize that 1 hour of hate takes more energy than 8 hours of work. He is wearing himself out. He is destroying himself by his own emotional and mental attitude. So one of the reasons why people lose love of life and lose the vim to live, lose gaiety of spirit, it's because more and more we are catering to neurotic attitudes. And these attitudes are nothing but energy wasters. They tear us down, they deplete us, and they finally leave us open to most any physical ailment that may come along. There's no need for us to permit this, but we do. So we tell people these things. We say to the individual, you have a very bad jealous streak in you. This jealousy is just as dangerous as a very dangerous bacteria. This jealousy can do you just as much harm in the long run as almost any physical ailment from which you can suffer. This jealousy can eat you out like a cancer. It can weigh you down and deplete you like a tuberculosis. Only you don't think of jealousy as a disease. You think of it as a well-justified emotion. But you have no realization of what it is doing to you. Now, long before it can maybe take you out of this life, this jealousy reduces your energy quotient so that other things no longer look good to you. You are tired all the time, having wasted your energy just in the process of being jealous. You have no energy, therefore, to do things to take your mind off of being jealous. And little by little, you just stew in your own juice. By degrees, this attitude has enfeebled you. It has vampirized your entire energy structure. Now, everyone has a few of these, but when people alternate from day to day between jealousy, fear, grief, anxiety, envy, ambition, avarice, prejudice, whereas all these patterns of complicated energy wasters are making a complete witch's brew within ourselves. It's not to be surprised that we're tired all the time, that even the best tonic advertised on television doesn't seem to cure us. We have got to take hold of something of this nature. What does Western man have to take hold of this with? Supposing he admits to himself, yes, I am stupid. I'm doing all these things I shouldn't be doing. I know I shouldn't be jealous of people. I know I shouldn't be envious of the success of others.
I know I shouldn't resent my in-laws. They're nice people. But I do. And no matter what I do, whether I affirm my love for them or I affirm my determination to get over it, I still feel just the way I did before. When I feel like disliking someone, I dislike them. Don't know anything else to do about it. So we try everything you can all think of. The religious people, maybe the family send them to the minister and have a long talk on the vice and horror of jealousy and how it might interfere with our ultimate rest in our heavenly home. We keep right on being jealous. At the moment, it is more fun to be jealous than it is to visualize the possibility of our heavenly home. And then there are so many other reasons why we may not make the heavenly home, but this is just one of a number of contributing causes. We have no answer. We can go under analysis for this. We can go to a psychologist who will ultimately become jealous of his money-making ability at our expense. We still will have the same attitude. Yet there must be some way of changing this. Occasionally, we know it is changed. One way in which it is changed is through a tragedy of some kind. Occasionally, jealousy works such a horrible misfortune upon us that we can no longer face it. We have to change because we have seen the horror of a terrible circumstance for which we are responsible. Another thing that helps sometimes is the fact that as energy becomes less, perhaps the memory is less retentive. Sometimes memories of these things fade out along with other energy losses. But that's a slow, hard way to do it. Then suggests that there is a simpler way to do it. And that this great pattern of jealousies and of hates and pressures and arguments and prejudices, all these little tricks and habits that are so obnoxious to other people, attitudes that we keep on holding even when we know we are breaking the hearts of those nearest to us, there is a way to get out of these things. And there is a way to put our lives together on a more constructive basis. It all depends upon one rather simple realization. And if the individual isn't ready to come to that realization, then his difficulties arise from karmic roots within himself. No individual can get over a problem until he deserves to get over it. He must have done something, made some move, made some effort, by which he can honestly say that he has really tried to get out of a bad situation, particularly one involving his own temperament. He cannot go along hoping against hope that some pill will sometime be discovered which will cure a bad disposition. Any pill that will cure a bad disposition will also destroy the good disposition and leave the individual a non-entity, which is one cure for a bad disposition, unconsciousness. But there are ways in which we can do a little better. And the whole point of Zen philosophy from the beginning has been to get away from this idea that man is small and problems are big, that the individual is some kind of a creature that must struggle on and on through time and eternity, trying to cope with something like a streak of prejudice in his own nature. What is this streak of prejudice that an individual can fight it for 50 years and still have it? Where did this prejudice come from? Is it an entity of itself? Is it actually a fork-tailed demon of some kind? Is it an obsessing thing that possesses him? What is a nasty disposition? Is it something so big, so terrible, so formidable, that it looks like one of Homer's one-eyed cyclops that can pick up mountains and throw them? What is this peculiar canker in ourselves, which we find it utterly impossible to cope with? What is this dispositional situation that is so much bigger than we are, that we have to go along and endure it the rest of our lives? then says that this tremendous problem just simply is nothing. That what we are really doing is bowing our lives down to phantoms. This attitude never was anything. This selfishness that we have, that has hurt us for a lifetime, actually isn't anything at all. It is just one point of view that we have made up out of our own way of life. This attitude began in us, not somewhere else. It is never for a moment capable of enduring any longer than we permit it to. Here we have 10,000 attitudes working through our natures all the time, and when we go to sleep at night, they all stop. Because while we are unconscious, we're not nursing them. While we are not aware of them, they do not exist. The moment we wake up in the morning, we carefully go through the ledger, gather them all up, and start again. We don't want to be regarded as having a tendency to forget even one of our faults. We must take good care of all of them. But there is no problem here, actually. The only realization that is necessary in this whole problem is for man to know that all of his attitudes are the products of himself. They are not something so big and tremendous. They are merely born in his own nature. They are no more important to him than any other thought he thinks. They are simply the sequences of negative thoughts or negative emotions which he is using to excuse himself from something. He is using these negative things and holding on to them simply because in some way they comfort him. They excuse him. They make it possible for him to justify his own inadequacy. If he couldn't think of some excuse for being inadequate, he would have to face the fact, and that is what he doesn't want to do. So it's so much easier to feel that other people have all the breaks, that he has been slighted, that his abilities have not been recognized, that his life has been more difficult than anyone else's. All these things add up to explanations and excuses why the individual has not carried his own personal life with dignity. So all this evasion problem is simply a way of anesthetizing the true basic character of the person. So Zen says to this man, go out in a garden by the side of a little waterfall, where some carp are swimming about the pool, a little stone lantern on the side of a hillock, a beautiful little pine tree, twisted and gnarled, struggling for survival on a little ragged cliff, stone walks and bridges, the old bench, a rustic house, a tea garden. Go there, sit down very quietly, and just let go of all of the tomfoolery that you have been clinging to so desperately. Instead of saying to yourself, life is a bore, or I am inadequate, or I can't face the problem, just be very quiet and begin to absorb into yourself the peace of nature. Little by little, as you sit there in this garden, and most of these gardens are meditation gardens, and that is one of the great joys and charms of them. As you sit there, things will begin to let down inside of yourself. You look around, and everywhere you look, there is beauty. Everywhere you look, there is harmony. And if there is any evidence of man at all in this little pattern of things, it is the kindly evidence of someone who has thoughtfully and lovingly worked with that garden. By degrees, the tensions relax, and you say to yourself, "My, that's a beautiful old stone lantern with a moss on it. It really is something that, a thing of real joy and beauty." Now, this is just an observation, but while you're making that observation, you're not sorry for yourself. By degrees, in the quietude of this, the kind of a garden, the quiet meditation, you begin to come closer to another kind of existence. The existence which, according to Zen, is the only one that is worth cultivating. This existence has nothing to do, really, with work or play or family or friends or anything. It is just a restatement of the fact the individual is alive. And being alive has a life to use. As he sits there quietly, he sees the golden carp in the pool flash into the air with a wonderful flash of golden copper light. This is life. The opening flower is life. Everywhere there is this quiet motion of things to grow, to flower, and to be fruitful. And these are the directives. These are the great purposes of life. And by this little garden pool, the individual can simply let go temporarily of a man-made existence and try to experience something of the total internal of himself. If he goes to a garden like this, maybe once or twice a week for 6 months, he will almost certainly, in the end, discover within himself a garden, a zone of tranquility within his own nature. He will begin to experience, for example, the need for that garden. He will experience the need to continually replenish the garden image within himself. He will find that he is also thirsty for peace as well as for power. In a little time, he discovers that there is an area within his own nature which is at peace. And that if he can give this area an opportunity to express itself, he can achieve a peacefulness of his own life that can be of the greatest value and importance to him. So out of his little Zen meditation, there comes only one perhaps important realization. And that is that there is not only turmoil in him, but there is also peace within himself. That deeper than the turmoil, deeper than the artificial patterns which he builds up, there is in every human being the great love of peace, the love of beauty, the love of tranquility. And the garden becomes the symbol of this. It is something to draw this out of man, whereas the busy road where the cars flash by, this releases from man the level of his confusion, the garden, the level of his peace. Under the pressure of the daily business of living, he is constantly manifesting into expression an energy to be used merely for survival, to drive that long, hard road on the freeway, to meet the competition of the day. He is always pouring out reserve and holding a defensive attitude of self-protection. In the garden, he doesn't have to. He suddenly realizes that what he feeds, he has. And that just as surely as he must accept pressure and sublimate it within himself, so also he must provide his life with non-pressured areas, so that he has some way of reconstructing his own inner convictions of what is right. Zen also by meditation leads to this concept of direct action. Zen, by removing from the attitude of the individual all mental and emotional overtones to action, permits the action to be performed with a minimum of stress of any kind to the individual or anyone else. Action becomes complicated because of our own emotional and mental reactions. But suppose instead of catering to these, We say to ourselves, this is next, therefore this we do, and that is all there is to it. Simplify the problem. Get away forever from this peculiar build-up. We all know the dental build-up, where the individual making an appointment with his dentist 3 days ahead suffers a little more each day as the appointment gets closer. By the time the appointment is really due, most people would cancel it if it wasn't for the fact they'd have to pay for the time. Many actually go to the dentist office and find that the toothache has stopped. Any excuse or any evasion, because they have built up a long anticipatory struggle with the dentist. This was more strenuous, of course, in the old days, when dentistry was a little more rugged than it is today. But still we do the same thing. If anything is going to happen a few days ahead, we begin to dramatize it, build it up, worry about it, think about it, so that we have used a tremendous amount of energy anticipating an event. For this reason, most people find that if there is something difficult to be done, it is best to make the appointment for the most immediate time possible. Do it immediately, before you have a chance to dramatize the situation in yourself. Do the same thing in your daily work and living. But pick out the most difficult project of the day and do it immediately the day begins. Select the time yourself, if it's possible, in which to assail the major difficulty of the moment. If there is a chore, for example, that you would like to put off more than anything else, some little peculiar situation that you have gradually built a complex against, do it first thing in the morning, before you have really a chance to get any more energy behind that complex. If there are things that you feel a special resentment for, solve them as quickly as you can. Never wait. And then move into the day with this Zen-like attitude, that there is only the simple matter of achieving.